Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to The World Transformed 2 on Fast Forward Radio. The World Transformed 2 is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find information about this series at speculist.com and at worldtransformed.com. This series explores 10 major transformations that will forever change our world and our lives. Some of these transformations are likely to be upon us soon. Others are already underway. Throughout this series, we're talking with futurists, scientists, philosophers, artists, pundits, and other thinkers to gain a better understanding of what we need to do to prepare ourselves for these changes and for life in a world transformed. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic, and I'm very excited about doing this first show in the World Transformed 2. They said it would never come, but here we are with our first show.
It's here, and we're both very, very grateful that it's come together. Phil, I have to hand it to you. You've outdone yourself getting awesome guests lined up for the show and for this series, and can't wait to talk to these folks and get their take on these ideas. It's going to be fun.
It is going to be really exciting. All I can tell you is there is a certain amount of work involved in leading up to something like this. The other day I was just finishing up a couple of touches here, a couple of touches there. There's still several things that need to be done. But as I was finishing all this up, I was thinking, boy, I'm exhausted. I'm glad this project is over. Oh, wait.
Oh, yeah, we still got to do, we got to do it.
Now. Actually have to do the series. So as of tonight, we are off and running with this special series, which I should mention is actually a follow-up to the original World Transformed, which we ran exactly 2 years ago on Fast Forward Radio. So for anyone listening, if you missed the original series and you want to catch up, we've got links and more information on the original World Transformed at Speculist and at worldtransformed.com. So in the coming weeks... go ahead.
I was just going to say, Phil, I've gone back and I've listened to it recently. And it ages remarkably well. You would think, well, this is a show about futuristic topics, and how that has a shelf life of like 1 week. Well, this not so much. We're talking big ideas in the World Transformed first in the first series, and now again, and so it aged remarkably well, and it's worthy of taking another look at.
I'm glad you said that, Stephen, because when I replayed those 11 shows, making up 10 parts, we won't go into that math, last fall, replayed the archived World Transformed shows on Saturday evenings. I was listening to those programs, and it occurred to me that when we did this series, there was an awful lot that we didn't have to do, because we didn't have to reintroduce these topics. They're introduced in the original series, so this gives us the luxury, the real opportunity to go do something different with this series, and what we are going to be doing is talking in a much more personal way about what do these transformations mean in my life? What are they going to do to my community? What are they going to do to the world as I know it, and to the future of my family, the future of my country, the future of my planet? We don't have to define what these things are. Now we can start talking about what they mean. I think that's the big distinction this time out.
Absolutely.
So in the coming weeks, we'll be talking about life extension, nanotechnology, transhumanism, artificial general intelligence, virtual worlds, post-scarcity, existential risks, the technological singularity, and finally, human destiny. Now, you'll note that there's some question as to whether each of the transformations we'll be exploring throughout the series is something that may happen or something that definitely will happen. So you might ask, are these possibilities or are they certainties? Are they mandatory or are they optional? Well, there's no question that our topic for this first installment is a transformation that is completely optional. And in fact, all too optional, some might argue, because tonight we're going to talk about the transformation of human thinking, a change that most of us would probably agree needs to occur, but will it actually occur? Will people actually change the way they think? Can people change the way they think? And if so, how can they change the way they think? So to guide us through these difficult waters, we spoke with three special guests.
Unfortunately, due to illness and some severe scheduling restraints, we were not able to get our three guests together as a panel as we had originally hoped, but we did do individual interviews with two of them and with our friend PJ Manning, our dear friend PJ Manning, who unfortunately was under the weather when we were planning to pre-record this show. We are using some archive audio from previous Fast Forward radio programs that are relevant to this topic. So we do have all three guests with us, and they have some fascinating perspectives on our topic. And so let's go straight to our discussions with those guests.
We're very pleased to welcome Thomas McCabe back to The World Transformed. Tom is the Executive Director of Humanity Plus. He is a scholar at Yale University and a software engineer at Google Research. He's been writing for H Plus magazine for over a year and is currently co-editor of that publication. Tom McCabe, welcome back to The World Transformed.
Hey Phil, how are you doing?
Well, great. It's great to be talking with you again. It's fun to take a little bit of time as we ease into this 10-part series to kind of set the stage, talking a little bit about what I've described as the most optional of all the transformations to come, and that is the transformation in how people think. And so we'll start with the most basic question. Do you think people really can change the way they think?
It depends on what you mean. If you mean change the way you think in the sense of just acquiring new facts, then the vast majority of humans who aren't affected by serious neurological disorders or whatever can obviously do that. Like, if you tell a person, you know, the Allies won World War II today, they, and you ask them tomorrow who won World War II, the vast majority of people will be able to do that. In terms of acquiring new skills, there it depends a lot more on the different sort of people that you might talk to. You have a spectrum of both different general levels of ability, what we call a Spearman G, which is a sort of a general measure of your ability to acquire new skills and learn how to do new things and so on and process information and complexity. And, of course, people have all sorts of different aptitudes. Some people are better at other things. Some people are better at verbal. Some people are better at spatial. Some people are better at emotional things and social things and so on. And so in that sense, there are certain human universals, like we can pretty much all learn to avoid getting run over by cars, or else we'd have a lot more fatalities and auto accidents than we do. But then there are some things like, say, advanced mathematics that most people seem to not be able to learn, no matter, at least using any current teaching techniques that we know of, no matter how long you go at it. In terms of ability to what we call, what you might call general intelligence, to not do domain-specific thinking, like a particular skill where you, say, play a video game and you're good at that video game, but your knowledge doesn't generalize, but to be able to reason out problems across every possible situation, what you might call Turing completeness, such that your mind can execute, however slowly or badly, any possible computation, can tackle any possible problem. It seems that most people have this during childhood, because if you are very young and inexperienced, you don't have a very good model of the world, you don't know how the world works. Like, say, if you look at how five-year-olds walk, they don't sort of walk like adults do. They sort of stumble around a bit and, like, bump into things and, like, run all over the place because they're still getting used to, still building a model of 3D reality because they don't have a lot of data, a lot of experience yet. And so young people, children, are adapted to putting more effort into building their models, into reasoning, into thinking about the world. And so young people in that sense, I guess, are more intelligent than the average adult, not in the sense that they know more or are more effective, but in the sense that they have better general purpose reasoning abilities if you look at someone at age 10 as compared to someone at age 20. In most people, it seems that like we're biologically adapted to lose those abilities around during puberty around the ages of 12 to 14. As you gain more experience, as you gain more knowledge, it's less important to continue refining your model of the world and more important to be able to use that model in order to take action and accomplish goals.
Right.
And so if you look at, say, your average 25-year-old versus the average 10-year-old, the 10-year-old can probably reason more effectively, but the 25-year-old has much more experience and is much more capable overall, can get a lot more stuff done. However, there seems to be, as in any population, this sort of small group of people who are anomalous in both directions, people who lose this ability particularly early and people who lose this ability particularly late. And the people who lose this ability particularly late seem to be rather important for the functioning of our civilization because we humans are adapted to a hunter-gatherer environment like the African savanna or the plains of Asia or whatever. And in that environment, the building a model of the world is pretty simple. I mean, you have the people around you, and you have, like, the deer and the lions and the trees and so on. But, you know, you can come to grips with all of that pretty quickly. But nowadays, in our modern civilization, the world is a lot more complicated. We have 7 billion people. We have civilization. And so it's to our advantage, in order for our civilization to function, for some people to specialize in sort of, like, childlike general intelligence reasoning thing to build models to figure out how the world works, to gain more information, to be curious, to stumble into things and try out new things and try experimenting and so on.
Do you think it would be a good ability if people generally could do that? Would that be a good strategy if it were possible to begin revisiting our models or rebuilding our models, if the capability existed, or do you think that might be less optimal for a society if everybody was doing it?
It would definitely work out better in the long term, I'm fairly sure. But in the short term, obviously, if you just flipped a magic wand, it would cause a lot of disruption. Just as if you flipped a magic wand and made everyone like English speaking and literate and know how to use a computer and know how to search the internet and know how to like get along in the world and get a job and get food and get housing and so on, which a lot of people can't currently do because they grew up in third world countries, they're poor, they have diseases of various sorts and so on. This would obviously be fantastic, but it would cause a lot of short-term disruption. And if you want to make the world a better place, I think you have to face that reality that long-term improvement almost always causes short-term disruption.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and I think when we talk about people changing the way we think, we're definitely the question was framed around the idea maybe of moving towards new strategies or different kinds of strategy. I really like that idea of the model building versus model application and the handoff that takes place somewhere very early on in life, really, when you think about it, considering people can expect to live 70, 80 years and they're done with their model.
Well, we didn't need to live 70 to 80 years. We're adapted to an environment in which we might live 30 years.
Right, right. So, you know, you get halfway there and you're not even halfway there and your model's built. And so that was a pretty good trade-off. You'd build a model for half your lifetime and use it for half your lifetime. But now it seems to be a bit out of kilter, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you look at, say, the United States, I think that we have, a lot of industrialized countries, really, is we have a fairly obvious problem with this in that as you get older, you have more years of experience. And so you have more years in which to accumulate every resource, everything you might want. You have more money. You have more social status. You have more reputation. You have a longer list of accomplishments. You have more friends, and you've been friends with them for longer because you've all been around for longer. You have more resources. You have more news articles that have been written about you, and so on. And so you have more skills, more knowledge, and so on, and so on, and so on. And so if you look at, like, who's running the country, who are the rich and powerful, who's calling the shots, it's almost all old people. You have, I believe there's not a single senator in the United States under the age of 40. I think there's like maybe 5 congressmen under the age of 40. There's no cabinet members under the age of 40. So 99% of the important people are drawn from like the upper third of the population in terms of age, which is in large respect how it's always worked. The Roman Senate, the word Senate is based on senatus, which is the Roman word for elder. The Senate was the council of old men. If you speed up change to a sufficient pace, as we seem to have been doing for the last 100 years, this becomes a problem because the old people who are in charge of everything aren't really adapted to the new technology of the 21st century. McCain, as Barack Obama famously pointed out in his campaign ad, doesn't know how to use a computer, can't send an email, probably thinks that Google is like a type of milk that you buy on the farm or something. And so it seems that we might see a lot of political upheaval as everyone comes to realize that the people who are in charge of everything are incompetent at using a lot of the basic tools of our society.
You know, my entire life, there's been this movement towards empowering young people, right? I mean, I grew up, I'm like a late baby boomer, right? So so when I remember when 18-year-olds were given the vote from 21-year-olds, and there was this whole idea of empowering youth. You know, they were marching, you know, protest marching, and they were opposed to the Vietnam War, and there was this huge move to you know, don't trust anyone over 30, and some of those kinds of ideas sort of first came into our like popular jargon. So here we see years later, it could be that evolution is kind of finally catching up with that idea, that we might find that that younger people, younger minds, are actually better equipped to deal with the challenges than older people. It's kind of almost a turnaround from the way things have, I guess, essentially always worked, right?
I mean, I guess it's always been like that. I mean, as the older generation gets old, they've always sort of woken up to find that, well, they're the older generation, and now there's a new younger generation, and now they're on the other side.
Right. Exactly. So I suppose it's a perennial problem, but certainly with a new twist on it, for sure. Well, let me ask you this: what are people not thinking about that they should be thinking about, or what are they spending a lot of time thinking about that might not be a great use of time to be terribly concerned about because there are more important things that we should be focused on? Are we distracted by things that we shouldn't be paying much attention to, and are there big, you know, elephants in the room, things that we should be focused on that we're not?
Mm-hmm. As to what people are not thinking about, everything, I think most adults just don't think at all.
That's pretty harsh. Okay.
It seems pretty harsh, but if you look at, say, why the famous essay Why G Matters, published in the late 1990s, I believe. It's a very thorough review of the literature on intelligence and human capability and so on. And the two lessons of it are, number one, there appears to exist, all the research supports this, that there's this common G factor that humans share that you can measure in various imprecise ways, which predicts in significant, not totally, but in significant respects, our ability to handle complexity and manipulate information and perform tasks and so on. So that's the first point. And then the second point is that people are stupid. People are stupid. And the only reason we can even talk about that we're even talking about the future is because a few people, including a few of my friends, are, I hope, very slightly less stupid than everyone else. Humans are the stupidest possible animal that can build a civilization at all because, well, we've been rising in intelligence through evolution, but as soon as we just barely crossed over that threshold of intelligence that allowed us to build a civilization, we built a civilization and then evolution basically stopped because civilizations work a lot faster than genetics do.
Right.
And so it's really a fascinating read. I highly recommend it. You find out interesting things like the average American can't read on a seventh grade level, can't, like, find an intersection on a map, can't, like, write a letter to the credit card company explaining a mistake in their credit card bill. Not finding the mistake in the credit card bill, mind you, just writing a letter explaining the mistake.
Right, right.
And, you know, a large portion of this is probably just that humans are pretty much the stupidest intelligences that can build a civilization. A lot of it is that our intelligence system derives from 19th century Prussia and is intended to train us to become good factory workers. But so there's a lot of good room for improvement, but overall, yes, people are stupid.
Hmm. Well, that's quite an indictment. Of course, if people are stupid, maybe they shouldn't be thinking about things too much, right? We don't want stupid people trying to think about things. We want smart people.
The trouble is, if humans are woefully equipped to handle these issues with future technology, but then of course the question is, if we don't do it, who else is going to do it? Are the chimpanzees going to do it? I don't think so.
I don't see them stepping up anytime. No, it's going to have to be us.
Evolution is not survival of the fittest so much as survival of the least inadequate.
And that's us.
Right. Okay. I hope. Maybe.
So far, that's us. Okay. Well, let's talk. Let's see if we can put a more positive spin on this as we wrap this up. What should we be doing differently as individuals and or as a society for in terms of trying to expand our thinking to be less stupid, both as individuals and as a civilization? What are the things that we could be doing? What are the things that you think we should be doing to prepare ourselves for these changes, to not just prepare for, but, you know, actively participate in, to leverage them, to take advantage of them, and to shape the future in the direction that we would like for it to go.
Mm-hmm. This is obviously a very, very far from perfect solution. It's the sort of obvious immediate one that comes to mind. But there is in psychology, there's a dimension of personality which we call openness in the five-factor model of human psychology. So openness to experience describes how your tendency to, like, seek out new experiences and experience new things and learn new things and grow and change and so on. And in general, I think our civilization pretty badly needs more of that. Like, most people, I think, do basically the same thing all day, every day, for years, and this doesn't seem like it's going to work. So in general, if you want to either help save the world or, you know, become better as a person and live a happier life, then I would probably recommend the most general recommendation I can come up with, not like become friends with this or that person or donate to this or that group or learn this or that skill or whatever. But the most general recommendation I would come up with is, you know, increase your openness, explore new things, read new books, do things that you were scared to do before, go to new places, like talk to people, be willing to change your mind. Be willing to change your mind is probably the biggest thing. Like, being willing to change your mind in response to evidence is how reason works, and yet almost none of us do it almost all of the time.
That would be a big one. If people could begin internalizing that idea of changing their minds about things, trying new things, changing their minds about things. You know, in another segment on this program, we're talking with David Brin, and he talks about something that he did when he was at university, and he recommends everyone do, which is at least once a week, walk into a building that you've never been in before and just start asking around, what goes on in here? What do you people do? What's the purpose of this? Actually expose yourself to something that you haven't seen, haven't thought about, aren't familiar with, and just try to broaden your horizons a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that's terrific advice, and I appreciate you taking the time to share with us. Any parting thoughts on how we might improve our thinking?
How we might improve our thinking. Let's see. I don't have any exact prescription for this, but there's this Enlightenment idea of using reason to figure things out. Like, in the olden days, people used to think of thunder like sacred mystery of the gods. And then people like realized that thunder and lightning went together, and that whenever you would see lightning, there would be thunder soon afterwards. Now, this isn't a perfect explanation. It doesn't include like all of the dynamics of electricity and so forth, but it's using reason to figure things out. It's looking at the evidence and seeing and coming up with ideas and seeing which of the ideas fit the evidence. Thunder is associated with lightning a lot more strongly than it's associated with flowers, say.
Right.
And so I don't really know. I don't think any of us really know how to teach this to people, and it's something that is very important to figure out in any sort of systematic way. But this whole thing of using reason to figure things out and come up with ideas and theories to explain the world seems like it's really important.
That does seem the way to go. If people can begin to actually even just examine their own process of thinking, even just come to realize that maybe they, as you mentioned earlier, aren't thinking, that maybe reason has a role to play, that maybe changing their minds about things, trying new things, all might have a role to play. Terrific ideas. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Cool. Thanks, Phil.
It's always a pleasure to introduce PJ Manny on Fast Forward Radio and here on The World Transformed. PJ Manny is a former chairperson of Humanity Plus. She's worked for over 20 years in the communications field. She has written for critically acclaimed TV shows such as Hercules, The Legendary Journeys, and Xena, Warrior Princess. She's the author of Why I Believe in Participating in the H-Plus Future and Empathy in the Time of Technology, How Storytelling is the Key to Empathy. PJ, it's wonderful to have you here.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm thrilled to be here, as always.
Well, of course, you're not really here. We've got you here in a virtual way. But that's good enough for us to address two of those topics I just mentioned in that introduction, storytelling and empathy, as it relates to how our thinking may change and how we can change our thinking. So, Stephen, let's start off talking about empathy a little bit. How would you frame a question about empathy for PJ?
I thought we mentioned something that was on Facebook earlier today. Alex Lightman, who has been on Fast Forward Radio once or twice, I forget, Phil, if he's been
at least
on board.
Yeah.
Okay. He said, you know the song, What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love? He says, if I was to rewrite that today, I would say what the world needs now is imagination, innovation, creativity, and speculation on the possible. And of course, I responded, and love, sweet love. So, anyway, you know,
and you were so
things,
right, Stephen.
let's not forget the love, sweet love, as we think about all these other things. But yeah, absolutely. I think actually, this is a speculative topic. I mean, empathy is. It should be. All these other things that we talk about: imagination, innovation, creativity, and speculation, whatever. I think they can grow out of empathy for our fellow men. So,
What good are they really if you don't have that? I think is the other interesting question. I mean, we have Michael Anisimov on all the time, and others from the Singularity Institute talking about the need for friendly artificial intelligence. And certainly we would want artificial intelligence to have all of those characteristics, imagination and creativity and all those things. But above all, we want the friendly, right? We want the nice. We want the good, the love from those entities. Or if the intelligence might be dangerous, it might not even be something we're interested in. So why would we feel any differently about people? What do you think, PJ?
Well, you have to understand that empathy isn't just something that people or potentially AIs have. Empathy is something that many animals have. In fact, most mammals we recognize have empathy. Because it is such a useful and powerful tool for survival and evolution, it makes complete sense that any other kind of created being would need that to relate to other beings in its existence. You know, empathy is one of these things that we for a long time thought only humans were capable of. But in fact, it's really seen in the animal kingdom as the result of nurturing. So you have parental, but more specifically maternal nurturing, the mother has to look at the child and figure out its various states of ease or dis-ease and figure out how to take care of those to provide for the child. The child, on the other hand, has to watch the parents and learn how to behave in the world, has to learn a certain kind of, you know, we would call it a moral structure, but in a sense, animals have a morality themselves. You know, apes and other large mammals like elephants and dolphins have a sense of fairness, of equality and sharing. And these animals aren't born with this. They're actually taught this. And the only way that a young animal is taught this is through emulation. So by watching their parents or other superior adults in their group doing things in ways that work and are considered the right way by that animal group, they learn how to behave. And empathy is a part of that.
All right, PJ, next question to you. This also hails back to those opening comments that I made a moment ago. Talk to us a little bit about storytelling, why it's important both for building empathy and for building bridges between the world we're in today and the world that we're seeking in the future.
What I think stories are great for is taking someone who would be considered the other, whom we might distrust, whom we might fear, because they're different than we are, and giving us a basis for commonality where we no longer fear them, they are no longer the other, they're one of us. And that's where empathy's real power lies. If you're using the empathy of storytelling to model very complex situations, I think that's not going to work. But when you're taking, you know, for instance, when we're looking in the future, we talk a lot about, you know, what happens when we have people, the haves and have-nots of transhuman technologies, et cetera. You know, we already have this now. We already have people who are getting superior health care, who are living longer, who are living very different lives than other people in the world who don't have those things. And it's very easy to demonize one side or the other as either, well, you know, they couldn't get their act together, so really they don't deserve it, or, you know, they have everything given to them on a silver platter. They're
right.
Taking stuff away from me, how you know, that's horrible. Instead of this demonization on either side, stories can bridge that gap. You know, one of the things
my
that
favorite
I'm fascinated
I was just going to say, my favorite story along those lines is probably Enemy Mine.
Yes.
That movie is just an awesome example of, you know, the other meeting each other and forced together and eventually accepting each other. It's a beautiful story. And you know, maybe we need more stories like that.
Well, I think we do because, you know, what we're going to, as just the fact that we now have the ability to communicate with people all around the world means that our once tribal brains are forced to empathize outside of our family, outside of our tribe, and forced to empathize with people of very different backgrounds, very different cultures, religions, values, morality, et cetera. And the only way we're going to be able to communicate is to find those bases of commonality and imagine ourselves in each other's shoes. And that's where geek culture comes in. Because in geek culture, we've been spending, you could say, 1,000 years, but really the last 100 years very intensely, taking the other and making it the center of our stories and, you know, later on the protagonist of our stories, where you were forced to relate to a character who was so unlike anything you could possibly experience on Earth. They were either superhuman, you know, it was either Superman or Frankenstein's creature or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde or Pinocchio or, you know, now we're talking more modernly, and an Enemy Mine, the kids in X-Men, et cetera, where...
Yeah.
You're now in the shoes of someone who isn't fully human. And you're siding with them.
Right.
Because you can understand what it's like to be them. And it's that act, this acceleration of empathy for characters that are not human, that I think is the best hope we have in the future of a socialization of people of different abilities, et cetera.
And that's exactly the kind of skill set, exactly the kind of mindset, exactly the kind of thinking that we need to increasingly have moving into a future where diversity plays a bigger and bigger role. Well, PJ, cannot thank you enough for virtually being with us. I'm sorry we only gave you two questions, but I will point out that that is two more questions than we gave to any other guest who wasn't actually here.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We have with us special guest David Brin. David is a scientist, speaker, technical consultant, and world-known author. His novels have been New York Times bestsellers, winning multiple Hugo, Nebula, and other awards. At least a dozen have been translated into more than 20 languages. His 1989 ecological thriller, Earth, foreshadowed global warming, cyber warfare, and near-future trends such as the World Wide Web. A 1998 movie directed by Kevin Costner was loosely based on his novel, The Postman. Welcome, David Brin.
We're very pleased and honored to have you here with us, David.
I'm always glad to be anywhere at my age, but especially with people who are discussing great ideas.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you with us. I know we in the original instance of The World Transformed, we were hoping to have you on a couple of years ago, and we had a bit of a logistical glitch on my end. So I'm really glad that you were patient with us, and that we get to have you with us tonight. So, looking at our topic for this evening, we're talking about, with all of these massive transformations that we'll be talking about throughout the course of this 10-week series, and we'll be getting into technologies and we'll be getting into the social changes that might occur. And we're beginning tonight by talking about how people look at the world and how they look at change and how they think about how we think about our place in the world. And I think we have to start with some very basic questions around whether our thinking can change, how our thinking can change. And let's start with the most basic question of all. This is binary. So if you decide to give a one-syllable answer, I'm asking for it. But David, first question is, can people really change the way they think?
Oh, well, of course. There are, you know, it all depends on what level you're talking about, but there are certain baseline things that we inherited through evolution. But all you have to do is look at the different ways in which babies get acculturated and the different ways in which societies wind up on average holding different assumptions. And you know that we change. And one of the things that the United States has always relied upon is the spectacular university system that we have for the last 100 years, especially since World War II. The rest of the world has sent their best and brightest over to be educated. We would skim off the top 10% to become Americans and then send the rest infected with our values. What a deal. Just the fact that Hollywood is considered to be probably the most important component of American imperialism by spreading different ways of thinking. In fact, back in the 1980s, I predicted that we would have our worst problems in the early 21st century after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which I also predicted. We would face a terrible crisis with one or another version of machismo. Probably Islamic, but I also thought it might be Hindi or Hispanic machismo, because Hollywood and other influences were changing the way women looked at themselves. So just the changing attitudes of girls and women prove that human beings are programmable, and there are many, many, many other examples. Can we change some of the underlying programming? Well, that may need to wait for the singularity.
And we'll be coming to the singularity as we work our way through the topics of the program. I think that's a very interesting way of laying that out. And I note, if I'm not mistaken, that your initial examples of, yes, people can change the way they think,
are not necessarily positive examples. Just the fact that we can change the way we think doesn't mean we're necessarily going to start thinking correct things or good things or helpful things.
Yes, the one of the you know, one aspect of this in my novel Earth and in The Transparent Society, my nonfiction book about freedom and privacy and all that. In both cases, I back in the 90s forecast that at this point in time, we'd have more and more problems with netizens, people on the internet, just basically crowding together in yes festivals, little Nuremberg rallies with people who believe the same thing and are reinforcing the same belief and avoiding anything that might inconveniently question their assumptions or their quote-unquote facts. And this has come true in spades. It's not just the internet that filters all this for people, but just the cable news stations. I mean, all of those who want to wallow in a particular set of hatreds watch Fox. There are others who go to other same think festivals. So the unwillingness to change, obstinacy. I think the greatest thinker of the 20th century, arguably, not inarguably, but potentially, might have been Alvin Toffler, who predicted what's called future shock. And I think we're in the middle of it right now. I think a substantial fraction of Americans, for example, are out of their cotton-picking minds, and they do not like the future. They have simply decided to that nostalgia is the thing to wallow in. They don't want to change. And change is, of course, the fundamental topic of science fiction, which I happen to write for a living. It's not science. Science is not the main topic. It's how human beings deal with change. Good change, bad change. Of course, bad change makes easier stories, which is why almost all the movies, sci-fi movies that deal with the possibility of advanced artificial intelligence, always go for the simple idiot plot that it will try to stomp us flat.
Right, right.
A pretty silly thing for AI to try to do, especially now that we've warned all the AI through these movies. I don't think they'll do it because we've warned them just how tough we are and how resilient we are, us old biologicals. I think they'll woo us into a false sense of security by giving us holodecks.
Once
we have holodecks, of course, no male human will ever be seen again.
Absolutely. Have you read The Dilbert Future by Scott Adams? He makes that prediction.
Yes. I thought of that before him, but we great minds think alike. Actually, that's not entirely true. What will happen is that men will disappear into their holodecks at age 17. And meanwhile, the women will be out in charge of the actual physical world. So they'll subtly reprogram they'll learn subtle techniques because the first few attempts won't work. We'll just get out and get mad. But they'll learn subtle techniques to make our harems, our holo harems, really start to bug us, just irritate us, you know, get on our nerves. And so age 40 will come out and we'll stretch and we'll say, oh, man, what was I thinking? Are there any boxes you need moving?
That is a
great way to put hormonally drenched, great place to put hormonally drenched young men. Only, you know, we won't be linked up to tubes and all that like in the Matrix. We'll be running around exercising in there. What the heck? I'm getting carried away.
No, it's fun stuff. Yeah, those are terrific scenarios, and I like what you said about winding it back just a bit because I really enjoy the holodeck doomsday scenario. It's something that Stephen and I have batted around a few times on the show, but this idea that people go to electronic media, that they go to the internet or they go to cable TV stations, or I see this in blogs and in comment sections in particular. People are looking to be reinforced in what they already think. And it seems that your comment about nostalgia rather than grappling with the future is
of a piece with that. That people are more, they tend to want to be reinforced around what they know and what they're comfortable with, rather than dealing with something that is as potentially disturbing, right, as some of these possible futures might be. So is it fair to say that one of the big changes in thinking that must occur, or that should start to occur, is that people have to start working outside of their comfort zones? Because once you get to the holodeck scenario, right, you're deepest into the deepest of comfort zones, right? And it seems like nothing good can come of that.
Absolutely. And this is why, you know, I was murdered in every one of my previous lives, because the one thing that goes from reincarnation to reincarnation. By the way, I ran into some people online who actually believed, were taking me seriously instead of a metaphor. So, just in case some of you are that dumb, no, I don't believe in reincarnation. But in all of my previous lives, I had the same personality. And in other words, I was murdered in every last one of them. I was throttled, I was garroted, I was stabbed, I was burned at the stake. Because I am a contrarian bastard. So all my libertarian friends think I'm a liberal. All my liberals think I'm a flaming libertarian. Because I tell them they should read Adam Smith and realize that Adam Smith, if he were alive today, would be a Democrat. The fact is that today I am paid to be like this. Naturally, I believe that people should go in front of a mirror, smack themselves across the face every morning and say, I need to find somebody who's going to question every one of my assumptions because I can't be relied upon to do it for myself.
Right,
This is the fundamental human conundrum, and that is we are such incredible geniuses. The one thing we're good at, all of us are good at, is delusion. Self-delusion, deluding others. It's why women are willing to be touched by males. For heaven's sake, what other possible reason could they have? I mean, women are good looking. We aren't. Look, we are utterly delusional, but we're also brilliant. And we come up with cool ideas. We come up with good stuff. And then we delude ourselves about the rest. The only hope we have ever had of being able to see through our delusions is called criticism. Criticism is the only known antidote to error. I've even made an aphorism of it, Cito Cate. And the fact is that this runs against another fundamental of human nature, and that is that we hate it.
Right.
We hate criticism, and in most of human cultures for 6,000 years, probably 20,000 years, the kings and the chiefs suppressed it whenever they could. So, you know, you can imagine Napoleon saying he has this great plan, like in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and he says, we will go into Russia, and some guy says, your emperoress, I hear they have snow there.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that the great innovation of the Enlightenment was not democracy or science or enterprise markets or justice systems. It was the thing that enabled all four of those accountability arenas to be productive and to create what's called positive sum games. If your listeners don't know what I mean by positive sum game, look it up. It is the most powerful and important concept, and it underlies absolutely everything we have. And the only way we got positive sum games through science and markets and democracy and courts is through this one little trick called reciprocal accountability. And that is that I cannot catch all of my delusions, but my enemies will catch them for me. They will do me the favor of giving me the criticism that I need to get better. And they will do it eagerly, and they'll do it for free. And you know what? I am so generous that I'll return the favor. I will criticize them for free. And this is what the kings feared. And this is what makes us great. And it is a complete irony. And without this, we are screwed. And that is what people are tending toward now. And that is, they are tending toward this business of avoiding criticism by hanging with people who agree with what they already think. So can people change their minds? Yeah, but it's painful. It hurts. And the Enlightenment was set up to see to it that we can't escape the inconvenient truths. Unfortunately, the more freedom we have, the more likely it is that we can avoid them. Well, we have to find a way to take this thing that gave us all our freedom, which is reciprocal accountability and criticism, and not use freedom to avoid the very thing that brought us to the party. But it's natural that I'm preaching that. I'm a freaking contrarian. I love living in a civilization in which we're poking at each other constantly. You look at my novels, at the end of every novel, there's 50 names of people who pre-read the novel, who I write to them and I say, yeah, tell me where you were even slightly bored, you know, so I can tighten that scene. That's what you're supposed to be. Is a, you know, that being a novelist and a reader, you're in a sadomasochistic relationship? Because the reader wants the writer to write a book so tight that the reader has trouble putting it down in order to feed the cat, in order to do homework, in order to go to sleep for work the next day, in order to feed the kids. If you make it hard, you know, the best compliment you can give an author is to go up to them and wag your finger at them and say, you almost got me fired. I swear, it gives me the biggest thrill when I hear that. I think, good, that means you'll buy my next one, doesn't it?
You know what's great, David? As soon as you said that about the relationship between an author and a reader being sadomasochistic, my immediate thought was, and I didn't ask the question, I think you've clarified, my immediate thought was, well, wait, who's which? But I think we know.
I don't know.
Depends on the author.
It goes the other way.
Yeah, it depends on the author. Certainly, we know how it works with you. We certainly didn't mean to imply otherwise. Okay, Stephen, where do we go next?
Let me do a follow-up to that. I mean, David, if it's our desire to be people that are challenged, I mean, how do we go about that? I mean, I suppose reading widely helps, participating in different forums, whether in the real world or on the internet or something where there is an opportunity for somebody to call you an idiot helps. But I mean, how do you go about, what are some of the best ways you can think of to get challenged?
Oh, well, you know, nowadays there are some lovely sites online where you can fan fiction, for example. You can join a community of other new novelists who will after you've read a bunch and commented on a bunch of others, then they will read yours and comment on it. It's a great big workshop in the cloud. You can do this in almost any way. One of the best places where the Enlightenment is most alive is a university. I mean, I'm very critical of students who go to universities and just, you know, go from their class cave to their, you know, dorm cave between all these buildings without going inside and knocking on doors and saying, excuse me, what do you do here? You know, I've every time I give graduation speeches or speeches at colleges, I always say, if you're not doing that at least once a month, preferably once a week, a completely randomly chosen building, randomly chosen floor, randomly chosen room, knock on the door and say, what do you do? What are you doing to change everything? I want to know about it. Then you're wasting our tax dollars spent on this university. That's the attitude. That's the attitude that'll give us Star Trek instead of Matrix.
Well, David, if we get Star Trek, if we get life extension or post-scarcity or artificial intelligence, I mean, then our external world changes, you know, obviously, you know, I mean, everything changes. So wouldn't that naturally, just change everyone's thinking along with it? Do we have to do anything, I guess, beyond just way for the future to show up to make people's thinking change.
Okay. Well, look, you can sow or you can reap. The fact of the matter is that Star Trek is portrayed as no bunch of lotus eaters. These are people who are who have things to do. They're busy. But the fact of the matter is, if I have to choose between creating a better world or just plain receiving it, but I'll take making it. And we have really serious work to do. We have stuff to do. I mean, good heavens, we may be God makers. The choice we have to make is, can we focus our attention well enough to be able to make good ones? Our descendants, our grandchildren. So far, things have been pretty darn good. Our parents, the so-called greater generation in World War II, they dealt with a lot of problems. They were heroic, and they were a bunch of racist, sexist bastards. But they primed us to rebel against the racism and the sexism and to discover environmentalism. And over to you guys. And I got to tell you, our kids, the ones I've met, are better than us. And that is precisely how it should be. Problem with the left and the right is they are attacking us from both directions, and the target in their sights is the can-do spirit. The spirit that got us to the moon, the spirit that made science, the spirit that made the technology that is causing problems but that might solve it. And the only way we're going to save the world and solve these problems is by combining vastly increased ethics with vastly increased technological power. Because only then can we finish the job of bringing 6, 7, 8 billion people fully into a modest Dutch level, Japanese level of middle class comfort, so that their children are safe and their children go to school and their children are problem solvers and happy people, but not the way Americans did it, with such incredible wastage of resources. But if we can do that, then we'll have ethically raised the human beings, and we can then go on and ethically save the world. The only way we can do that is if we combine increased ethics with truly ambitious, truly arrogantly ambitious technological prowess. And the problem we face is that the left and the right are both telling us over and over again to be cynical. Look, here's the sales pitch, all right? We have done a lot to fix ourselves and improve ourselves. We've been engaged in self-improvement campaigns ever since the Enlightenment began, but certainly since World War II, we've been engaged in relentless, really, really ambitious self-improvement campaigns. And if he were alive today, Martin Luther King would say, wow. We have done a lot. And what this proves is that self-improvement works, and that we should do more, because if we stop here, we're screwed. We're dead. But look at those two statements. We've accomplished immense amounts of wonderful things with self-improvement so far. Therefore, let's do more. Nobody is saying that. Nobody is saying that pitch.
Well, can I challenge that? I think that the problem is that no one in the political spectrum is saying that. It seems to me that you hit the nail on the head, that both the left and the right have backed away from endorsing the can-do spirit and having a vision of the future and pushing towards a vision of the future. It seems to me that they've given up on the actual world, that they exist to win in some rhetorical sense, or maybe to get a share of the tax dollars, right, rather than to actually do things.
Well, no, I'm not so sure I'd say just for tax dollars. The left is sincere in wanting to improve the world. Look at the movie Avatar.
Mm.
All it has is guilt trips. We've had guilt trip, guilt trip, guilt trip. There's not a single pat on the back.
Right.
Where Star Trek had pats on the back. There was a great movie 20 years ago called Alien Nation that patted us on the back and said, wow, what we could achieve if we only doubled and tripled what we've already done. The normal person, the normal American, wants to get on with it.
Right.
But we're being crowded by this insane left-right so-called political axis that we should quit because nobody can define it. You get 20 people in a room, not everyone will define it differently. It doesn't map onto anything useful, but the biggest reason to stop using it is because it's French. I mean, we're crying out loud.
Yeah, why would we be using a 200-year-old French model, for heaven's sake? What is the explanation for that?
God, I lived in Paris for two and a half years. Give me a break.
Well,
I jabbered on there.
No, that's great stuff. And what I was going to say was I think we've given you a big enough challenge of figuring out human thinking and what needs to happen with thinking without us trying to take on what to do about this political spectrum, because it really does seem to me that when I hear people talk about progress, I hear technology enthusiasts talk about it. I hear science fiction fans talk about it. It seems to be in a context other than the political, because the political context has become so much about getting the power or getting the power back or getting the other guys in the wrong to the extent that it's really hard to have a vision of
All we have to do is go back to negotiating with each other,
yeah,
to admitting that the other guy might have a point, as stupid as he is.
Right. I think so too. I think that I despair whenever I run into political discourse. It's one of the reasons actually that we never allow politics to be discussed on Fast Forward Radio, unless a guest brings it up, and then of course we do.
Well, sorry about that. Look, if I like to poke at both directions equally.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm more comfortable doing. Never mind. Let's go on.
Okay, intriguing. Maybe we'll pick that up at some point. But just to drift away from the political for a bit. How about this question? What are people not thinking about now that they should be considering, or what are they thinking about that is probably just a big waste of time, or that is on the wrong track? Here's my example, all right, and this is a weird example, but I remember that my grandfather was fanatical about he would never eat butter. You know, this is like back in the 60s and 70s, and margarine, right? Parquet margarine, and he was gonna live a long time because we knew the truth that butter's a killer and eating margarine. Of course, then you find out later it's like, oh great, he was clogging himself up with all those trans fats, and he probably hastened his death by avoiding eating butter. So there's these like just factual error wrong things that people get into their heads and they move ahead with, and also just the actually that turns out that's just a major distraction. It's not the thing we should be thinking about. Do you have any of those in mind that you could point out, things that we're just on the wrong track, we're looking at the wrong things?
Well, obviously, you know, we should watch Woody Allen's Sleeper and all eat deep fat and smoke cigarettes, because everything that he had been told in his health food restaurant was
wrong. It turned out in the end that chocolate was the big miracle cure for everything, which is odd because there has been some pretty good words that have been said about chocolate over the last few years, so that movie might be prophetic.
Indeed. Well, look, what worries me is that, you know, people should be thinking about the singularity, of course. Unfortunately, we're stuck with, I have an essay online that people can look up with my name, and Singularities and Nightmares, or through the Lifeboat Foundation. And I talk about the grouches and the transcendentalists, and there have always been transcendentalist mystics who don't like this world and want to go to a better one. And sometimes they were the priests inside the temples. Sometimes they were wearing loincloths and beards down to their navel and prancing outside the temple, like in Monty Python, screaming at the top of their lungs. Today we have the same human personalities. Those who cannot do science calculate, you know, biblical things and tell everybody to sell all their cars and meet on a mountaintop to greet the Mayan dawn. But those who can also do science have a place to go, and that is the singularity. And so we have these wonderful guys. You and I know them. They're so much fun. They're huge fun. They are promising us variously that we'll all become gods in 20, 30, 40, or 50 years. And here's the thing that determines how many decades. It's how old they are.
Right, right.
So Ray Kurzweil, who's 70, he says it's just going to be in the next 20 years, whereas the young guys I know who are in their 30s, they say, oh, Ray, it's going to be a lot harder to calculate and figure all this stuff out. It's going to be happening more like 40 years. Very convenient, kind of hilarious, until you stop and you realize what they are doing to our heads. And that is, these guys are messing with the great... I mean, I'm 60 years old. These guys are messing with the great solace that all of us had whenever our time came. And that was, this happens to everybody.
Mm.
It's my turn.
Right.
These bastards, when it's my turn in 30 years, God willing, you know, hey, 40. It's still going to come.
Right.
And when it comes, I am going to say, you sons of bitches. You promised. You promised.
And that, you know, that's I'm trying to think if somebody has an essay about that. It's like the last person who dies, right? The you know, the last stop on the train before the whole thing just kicks in. It does seem grossly unfair, doesn't it? But it will. I mean, it could be 150 years from now, right? So, if that's any consolation to you at all.
Well, consolation, yeah. That's a real bitter consolation. Oh, boy, my kids get to follow me into death. And
right,
And they get to feel that.
Yeah.
Aggravation. Look, the point is you have the grouches on the other side, like Nicholas Carr and Bill Joy, who admit that the singularity is coming. They just think it's going to leave us behind. At the one extreme, there's the silly Matrix Terminator stomp us flat. But even if they are kind, they'll pat us on the head, you know, give us whatever we need, and we'll be pets. And Bill Joy does not want to be a pet. And to an extent, I don't blame him. Now, I wrote a post-singularity story that people can buy on Amazon, called Stones of Significance. It's hard to write a story set after the singularity, after everyone's become gods. I think I did a pretty good job, and it portrays the best conceivable that I could conceive singularity from the point of view of people who want to bring some of the meat along. You know, some of the human body, some of the human values, some of the human physical experience.
And that's a real challenge, isn't it? I think that imagining what comes beyond that. We've actually we have the audacity in this series. Our second to last show is about the singularity, and then our final show, the tenth show, is everything that happens after that. Right. So I'm going to have to brush up on your short story before before we take that one on. But it's hard to get your head around, you know, what occurs beyond what's defined as the point beyond which you can't reliably make predictions or can't imagine what's going to happen. But there is that real fear that we get to a point where we're not us anymore, where we've left everything behind, and it's not even our story anymore. It becomes someone else's story.
And that may be the explanation for why we haven't seen signs of aliens in outer space. I mean, this is one of the latest theories for what's called the Fermi paradox, why we don't see any signs of the great big galactic ambitious enterprises that as recently as Star Trek we thought we'd be doing. In any event, you're welcome to clip out this portion that I just did and use it for your singularity part.
we might just have to revisit that when we get to that. When we get to that program. But what I like about talking about thinking here in the first show is that we can touch on so many of these, because the singularity is kind of the big one, right? When you look at things that, from certainly my standpoint, Stephen, I think you would agree, people aren't thinking about that they should. Actually, just kind of acceleration of technological development in particular. And the possibility of post-scarcity is another one, the possibility of radical abundance and what that does to all of our assumptions about the economy, right? There's things that we seem to be near the precipice of that is not really in people's imaginations. It's not part of how they think about where the world is going to end up, and yet the world might well end up there.
Yeah, well, Fred Pohl portrayed a post-scarcity world, I think, in The Midas Plague or one of his books. It was brilliant. As far as I'm concerned, we should have such problems.
Right.
You know, we have to reach the point where we can efficiently, using as little of the earth as we can, make sure every child has a clean bedroom of his or her own and the clothes to wear to school the next day. When we have all that, then, you know, I over to you, next generation. May you have different problems than ours. And you know, that's the best we can hope to will our children, is different problems than ours, and perhaps less immediate, less radical ones, less scary.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, you know, you're talking about ideas. You know, one idea that I've been trying to, I was invited to the National Institutes on Drug Addiction, and I gave a talk there about my paper about self-righteous indignation. And my paper basically, you know, it was published scientifically. It promotes the notion that we are looking at addiction all wrong. Addiction is what we think of addiction, things like heroin and gambling. These are methods by which people trigger processes, pleasure processes, and reinforcement processes in the brain that are already there for perfectly good evolutionary reasons. When I first held my firstborn child, I smelled his head and became addicted to that aroma.
Mm.
He's 19 years old and taller than me. I grab his neck and pull him down so I can smell his head.
Right.
it's a method by which nature makes us addicted to things that we ought to be addicted to. That's what love is. It's what love of music, love of one of the most important addictions is love of the exercise of your own skill. These are things that if you're already addicted to all of these things, the statistics show that you are less likely to become addicted to alcohol and tobacco and especially drugs or rage or gambling. If you already have these processes that are triggering these sites in your brain, releasing the endorphins and the enkephalins and the dopamine. Now, the problem we have is that we have not yet made a science of this and taught people how to do this when they were in elementary school. Hey, you know, did you know that Johnny has no addictions? You know, here's a list of some cool things that we think might be appropriate for his style. And you really need to get him into some of these wholesome habits, or he might be in danger of being recruited for a drug or going in for some of the nastier things by which we dope ourselves. And one of the things that we dope ourselves with is self-righteous indignation. I mean, you've been indignant, I'm pretty sure. I've been indignant. It's a familiar feeling. And if you've ever looked in the mirror when you were self-righteous, in a self-righteous snit, an honest person looks in the mirror and says, "Ooh, this feels good." And I think that's an underlying reason why our nation is being torn apart. Because the underlying reason for culture war that goes beneath them all is that a large fraction of the baby boomers have always been indignation junkies. You know, we just are addicted to it. And so, you know, what better way to get the high over and over and over again that you get from being part of the small group of people who are in the know, who know the conspiracies, and are surrounded by clueless, idiotic sheep for neighbors. Well, you know, I think it's tearing us apart, and Lord knows I'm capable of indignation, self-righteous ranting. As a matter of fact, maybe that's what I've been doing just now.
But surely it's okay when you do it, right? I mean, the whole time you're describing that, when I get really indignant, it's because there's a reason, okay?
What I just demonstrated is what's more important to me is the next cool thought.
Right.
Even if it makes fun of myself.
Right. Absolutely.
And that's an addiction that in this society is wholesome enough to get me really well paid. But as I said, in other societies, it got me killed. So in this society, being addicted to, hey, what's the next cool idea, whether even if it's critical of me, this is adaptive and wholesome in this society. And now you know the secret. Now you know my secret. Now you know why I am so loyal to the American Enlightenment. It's the only one that would ever pay me to be like this.
Oh, there you go. Okay, so it's the not only is it the secret sauce for the future, but you can make money at it. I think that's a nice combo right there, huh?
Look, if the alternative is all the other cultures that would have killed me,
right? Yeah. Not a tough choice.
No. I am very loyal. I am very loyal, militantly loyal. And so what we're talking about is different ways of thinking. And so, you know, we have that is one aspect, and that is people aren't aware of habitual patterns that they may be repeating in order to get a high. And that's an example of the kind of repetitious thinking that is just makes people less creative and useful.
Well, the great thing about having that perspective on it, if people could at least get that much of a perspective on it, would be to recognize that there are other highs to be had from other ways of thinking that might be more constructive, that might ultimately get you more of the, not only more of the high, but the more of the other things you're trying to make happen in this world.
Not only that, but I think that if we recognize that self-righteous indignation is actually a drug high, it would put self-righteous indignation in some ill repute. Remember that almost all of our political movements eventually get taken over by indignation junkies because they have the stamina. And they can, if there's an internal fight over the organization, they can defeat the moderates by saying, you're not passionate enough.
Right, right.
Think about what would happen if we knew that self-righteous indignation, if overindulged, was a drug high. Then all of these screamers would lose credibility to lead our political movements and our organizations. Moderate people who are willing to negotiate might actually rise up. Well, you know, it's a dream. I write science fiction.
It's a wacky idea, but it might just work.
You want a wacky idea? How about my Helvetian War from Earth?
Okay, go.
All right. Well, in my novel Earth, it's around the year 2038, and people look back to around the year 2020 when the last great war took place. It was the entire world against Switzerland.
Switzerland could not be neutral that time, huh?
Nukes were used, and the Glarus Alps were turned into slag. But we finally got the bank records. And, you know, this was, look, people were going, hey, man, funky, wow, what were you high on when you wrote that? And now I'm getting almost weekly, I'm getting email from people saying, how did you know? Because every month there's something in the news about how the Swiss are backpedaling and the other banking institutions are backpedaling and about how some of these countries that are achieving freedom in Africa and the Arab world, the new movements are demanding access to the bank records. What's it going to be like if this Arab Spring really spreads, and possibly you get a consortium of 20 or 30 third world nations who realize that the only way that they're going to be able to apply the kind of pressure that will actually get them what they need, and that's their money back, is if they at least officially declare war. Because when they're at war, they can attach Swiss assets, you see,
right,
outside of Switzerland. When they're at war, they can attack with stink bombs. When they're at war, they can make it clear that this is something to be taken seriously. They can make a speech saying, we don't want a single Swiss person killed, but anybody who makes them smell bad at any point in time is going to be our friend. But, now, that would be an unusual war.
That certainly would. You know what? That is a scenario I've never heard before, but it's completely plausible once you step it through us. It's something to look for. And that's definitely something that, swinging back to the question we asked earlier, things that people aren't thinking about that could come to pass.
Yeah, you run into this all the time. It's my job. You know, in my nonfiction book, The Transparent Society, Will Technology Make Us Choose Between Freedom and Privacy? I take on the people who are trying to secretly spy on us, you know, the elites. But I also take on some of our defenders of privacy because they're defending the wrong part of the wall. You know, if you think that you're going to prevent Big Brother from spying on us by passing a law, as Robert Heinlein once wrote, the only thing achieved by privacy laws is to make the spy bugs smaller.
Right.
Look, I tell these people, in all of human history, can you point to one example ever of the elites of society allowing themselves to be blinded? It won't happen. If you want to check it out, go down to the zoo with a pointed stick, climb into the baboon enclosure, and try to poke out the eyes of the biggest baboon.
Right, right.
Here's a clue. He won't let you, but he will grudgingly let you look at him. Quis ipso custodes? Who will watch the watchman? The only answer is us. Now, I helped coin a term that answers the question of surveillance, and that is called suvalence. S-O-U-S, valence. Look it up. It is looking back from below. Sur means looking down from above. Suvalence means looking up from below. Going back to the Enlightenment, that's how we've done it. We've done it imperfectly so far. Elites can still have an advantage, but we've had more equality than previous civilizations. And one of the reasons is that we have the Enlightenment habit of looking back. And that is an underdeveloped idea that people need to be talking about.
David, we are out of time, basically, but I wanted to ask you before we sign off here, is there anything you can reveal about your latest project that you're working on?
Yeah, tomorrow or the next day, I will finish my first big Brin novel in 7 years. It is a testament to how much I like you guys that I took an hour away from this endgame to talk to you.
Well, we are truly honored that you would do that, and that you have finished the book means that you know, once we've wrapped up The World Transformed here in 10 weeks or so, we'll have to bring you back on the program and talk about the book once you're actually rolling that out. I think that would be you know, since we're taking you away from doing your work, that would be
the
least we could do.
About 10 months from now.
Okay. All right.
All right, guys.
We'll start penciling that in. Well, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much we've enjoyed talking with you. It's been worth the 2-year wait to have you be part of The World Transformed. And all the best to you with your book and with all your endeavors, David Brin.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of the World Transform 2. We want to thank our guests for guiding our thinking on these critical issues. We'd also like to thank our partners for helping to make this show possible. Those partners are the Foresight Institute, Humanity Plus, Singularity University, and the SENS Foundation. You can find information about all of those organizations at worldtransformed.com, and we will be presenting more information about each of these groups, these very valuable groups, important groups, in upcoming installments of the World Transformed 2. So, Stephen, it's the time of the program when normally we would have music, but I guess that's not part of our agenda for this evening. What's happening with music on the World Transformed?
Well, we just can't not have music all together, can we? I mean, that's sort of a tradition of Fast Forward Radio. But we're going to do we're handling this just a little bit different throughout this series. We're not going to be using popular music. We're not going to be using the MusicAlley.com website as our normal source. We're doing something entirely different, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Well, we're very grateful to our good friend Jean-Sébastien B. Muse, who is the founder of the Singularity Network, in addition to being a talented composer and producer of music. He put together the music that you heard at the beginning of this program, and now that we've come to our conclusion, we will play that theme. We're calling it the World Transformed theme. It actually has a different title, but that's what we're calling it throughout the duration of this program. We'll be playing that at the beginning and end of each of these shows because, as you said, Stephen, it just wouldn't be Fast Forward Radio or the World Transformed without music, would it?
Absolutely, we need it.
All right, well, our special series continues next week with a discussion of Mortality Transformed. Our guests will be Aubrey de Grey, Maria Konovalenko, and Terry Grossman. For more information about these programs, please visit us at speculus.com or at worldtransformed.com. We look forward to being with all of you throughout this entire series. And until next time, live to see it.